Welcome to TP Talks, PwC's Global Transfer Pricing podcast series, where PwC tax professionals share insights on today's key transfer pricing developments. Our podcast today is a special edition podcast covering the OECD's final paper on the transfer pricing aspects of financial transactions. We will be releasing three special edition podcasts focusing on the impact of the final paper from a regional perspective. This podcast is our second installment covering the Asia-Pacific region. Dan Pybus, a director in our London office, is the moderator for this series, so I will hand it over to him to kick it off and introduce the panelists who have called in to provide their specific insights. Dan, over to you.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. My name is Dan Pybus, a director with our London Transfer Pricing team, specializing in financial transactions. Welcome to our episode regarding the OECD's final paper on the transfer pricing aspects of financial transactions. This special edition podcast series forms a three-part series focusing on the regional impact of the OECD's final paper. I'm here today with Ed Bagdasarian, a transfer pricing partner in our PwC Sydney office, Jessica Yin, a transfer pricing partner in our PwC Shanghai office, Peter Bruin, a transfer pricing partner in our PwC Hong Kong office, and Lin Tay, a transfer pricing director in our PwC Singapore office. Welcome, everyone. I guess before we dive into the questions, just to give a brief recap as to where we've got to with the OECD. So the paper, which was released a couple of weeks ago, is the final version of this financial transactions paper, which is a draft was released a couple of years ago. This final version will become chapter 10 of the OECD guidelines. And I guess a couple of the key themes which have come out of this paper, given it's the first time the OECD have really reflected on financial transactions, is really drilling down into the contractual terms of an arrangement and saying, well, do these contractual terms actually tie with the economic substance of the transaction? Is this aligned with what the group has done more generally, a concept called delineation within the paper? And they've also looked at things like credit rating and said, okay, we know that typically groups might have looked at standalone credit ratings, but we do think that you need to take into account group affiliation and implicit support. So that's another key theme which has come through from the paper. Alongside which is then a lot of general comments around treasury centers and how we go about pricing intercompany debt, talk of guarantees, and again, how we use different methodologies to price guarantees. And finally, touching on captives and what some of the issues are around captives, how they can be used, and also how you then determine and price the premiums and whether or not those premiums should indeed flow to the captive or, again, should be delineated and maybe those premiums should flow elsewhere. So quite a number of areas within the paper to touch on. I guess, Ed, if I come to you first, what are some of the key areas that you think are going to be impactful for you in your region?
Yeah, thanks, Dan. And if I start by saying, I guess, when I look at the region, Australia is a relatively developed and mature market when it comes to transfer pricing and financial transactions with what I'd say is a skilled tax office with a lot of experience with key financial transactions, transfer pricing cases. And with this backdrop, I guess there are two aspects I want to speak about around what's quite notable in regards to the paper and Australia in particular. Firstly, a strong focus for our tax office or what comes through in this paper is what you mentioned, Dan, around the accurate delineation of the transaction. And what does that mean? When you look at pricing any financing arrangement, intercompany financing arrangement, the first questions that are often critical in a transfer pricing analysis are questions around, well, what's the objectives of the borrower when it comes to the instrument? Is it general financing, acquisition financing? Is it short-term, long-term? What kind of transactions have been undertaken by the entire group with third parties in same or similar circumstances? What are the options that are available to the lender and the borrower given the objectives of each party in respect to the financing arrangement? And from these questions, the key terms and conditions and the type of instrument which we're looking to delineate falls out. And the reason why that's important is because once you know what the instrument looks like and what the relevant arm's length terms are, then we know what it is we're trying to price. And then the benchmarking and the economic analysis follows. And secondly, on the question of pricing, the paper does go into quite a bit of detail around implicit support and the need to consider affiliation with the broader group. this is a very key focus of the ATO and transfer pricing practice in Australia, especially with the majority of our debt being inbound focus. And therefore, in any transfer pricing analysis, a detailed exercise is expected around the question as to whether there should be any change in the credit rating of the borrower due to its affiliation or being part of a broader member of a multinational group. And both of these aspects need to be considered around the question of evidence. And while it starts with transfer pricing documentation as the base, the evidence that a taxpayer keeps on file is critical in the context of any review. The facts, the data, the correspondence which supports any assertions, discussions with third parties, etc. And we can talk a lot more about the importance of evidence and contemporaneous documentation later on as part of this podcast.
That's great. Thank you, Ed. That's really interesting. So I guess maybe moving to Jessica next, how did things look from a China perspective?
Well, different from Australia, I think there has been no specific guidance in the Chinese regulations on financial transactions transfer pricing. So it will take some time for the taxpayers as well as the Chinese tax authorities to digest the paper. But a couple of the key observations, the first one would be accurate delineation. Recharacterization from debt to equity opens a new door for the Chinese tax authorities to challenge the deductibility of interest expenses before corporate income tax. The second one is options realistically available for both borrowers and lenders. The prevailing interest rate in the China market is still quite high if you compare it to the Europe or US markets. The interest rate could lead to potential challenges from the tax authorities. For example, if a China entity as the lender may be expected to earn a high interest income, while an overseas entity as the borrower could be expected to pay a much lower interest expense, sometimes it would be quite difficult to reconcile the two. The third one is reallocating a return for the treasury functions. There are some practical considerations, in particular in a cross-border context. The form that this remuneration takes is important. For example, whether to have this as a service fee or interest spread can have different implications on remittance, as China has forex control and VAT, withholding tax, and so on. Another one is the lack of external comparables when benchmarking RMB loans. The amount of available data are RMB loans in the market is not as extensive as loans in other currencies. Secondly, the lack of consistent and transparent credit rating systems in China compounds the issues when pricing interest rates. Therefore, significant adjustments may be required to perform comparability analysis, which in turn means increased uncertainty during dispute resolutions with the Chinese tax authorities. Lastly, I also want to briefly touch on cash pooling, as using cross-border cash pools in China has become increasingly popular, in part due to the gradual relaxation of cash pool rules in China. Accurately delineating the cash pool transactions, performing cash flow and liquidity forecasts, and carving out longer-term unidirectional cash movements will be a coming challenge for treasurers and may become a risk area for many groups to have such structures in place.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jessica. Peter, from a Hong Kong perspective, any similar or different messages?
I think Hong Kong's a very interesting case because it does come at this from the Hong Kong tax authorities come at this from a very different perspective, and I think the experiences of a number of Hong Kong taxpayers are very different. I think you have to put into context, Hong Kong is actually a very large capital exporting territory. So in the main part, it's very difficult to get interest deductions in Hong Kong for related party debt, for kind of inbound debt, other than if you have a formal treasury center or you're a financial services business. So we don't really have the issues on the deductibility side as often. So the focus is very much on lending. And I think this is partly because, up until very recently, Hong Kong didn't have a formal transfer pricing law. And we're really getting this formal transfer pricing law. We got it in 2018. And most groups have not fully kind of geared up for that yet. And in particular, it's been very common for Hong Kong groups to in effect, move cash and financing around their group trust with interest-free intercompany balances, which kind of have some of the aspects of kind of the flexibility of debt, but equally aren't really loans. And in many cases, kind of almost look like quasi-equity because they never expect to be repaid. So we actually have a real big issue in Hong Kong around delineation and really going and kind of working out for those kind of Hong Kong groups that have lent overseas, really kind of is what they have provided those funds for, is it in substance more like an equity or a capital injection, or are these interest-free intercompany balances really, should they be characterized as loans and have interest imputed? And that really is an exercise which many Hong Kong groups are going through. And not just Hong Kong groups, because you have to remember a lot of multinational groups use Hong Kong as a center for financing into China. And equally, a lot of Chinese groups use Hong Kong as a kind of a center for managing their offshore kind of cash and financing positions and do their lending overseas and funding overseas. So it's very closely interrelated with a lot of the rest of the region too.
Great, thank you, Peter. And finally, Lynn, coming to you in relation to the Singapore impact.
Thanks, Dan. Singapore had issued specific guidance on transfer pricing relating to related party loans. I think one of the things that I've noted is that the paper that OECD had issued refers to implicit support and being part of a group membership. This interesting to see how the IRAs current stand as to their preference of using standalone credit rating for borrowers and how they may intend to reconcile this with the latest OECD paper. Singapore, of course, is not an OECD member, but then again, we do want to see if the IRAs will kind of see if they make any alignment or give clarifications as to situations whereby they may consider implicit support in their credit rating of borrowers. The other thing I want to mention is that in the last quarter of 2017, the tax authorities had also introduced new laws in which it allows a recharacterization of any related party transactions if the terms and conditions it's not comparable with what we see in third-party arrangements. I think, again, you know, the point about the substance, looking into the terms and conditions of the financial transaction rather than just what is the appropriate pricing, that then also goes into the debt equity characterization argument and the extent in which this paper again supports what in the law Singapore has introduced. And I guess it's interesting, and it'll be interesting to see the additional focus that the IRAS may be taking. Singapore is also a center for many treasury centers of groups. So you have inbound and outbound loans. The extent of the tax questions that we've seen is whereby Singapore is a borrower. So in terms of the questions as to the interest expense that is being claimed in Singapore, the concern by the tax authorities to date has been whether the interest as borne is excessive and hence asking taxpayers to substantiate the interest rates that's being applied. But notwithstanding, of course, there's many outbound loans that's being given. Then, of course, the point about terms and conditions as well as implicit support and how that interacts with the challenges that the IRAs may take in the future. I think that's something that group should take note of. Recently, we just had our budget on 19th of Feb, and they have further extended the Financial Treasury Center tax incentive to December 2026. So, you know, this is an area in terms of TP around Treasury Centers will continue to be an area of focus by the Singapore Tax Authority.
Thank you, Lynn. Some interesting reflections so far. I guess one of the key things I'm hearing is that the OECD paper does deviate from some of the local legislation. Maybe, Ed, if I come to you first, how big are some of those differences that you're seeing?
Thanks, Ben. And I'd say, look, we wouldn't, from an Australian perspective, we don't have any direct contradictions per se to what's in the paper or the arm's length principle. However, it is worthwhile noting that a few years ago, the tax office did release what's called a practical compliance guideline or a PCG, which is basically a risk framework for analysing cross-border related party loans and other financial instruments in the Australian market. And the way the PCG works is that it contains a bunch of quantitative and qualitative factors which you apply to your related party financing instrument in order to come up with an overall risk score for your instrument from an Australian transfer pricing perspective. The factors that are quoted in this PCG are all common aspects for pricing financial instruments, such as the spread over third-party funds, subordination, currency, other exotic features, leverage and coverage ratios, etc. And the PCG score for a taxpayer often needs to be disclosed within the tax return as part of the annual filing obligations of the company, or often is, almost always is asked by the tax office as part of a risk review. Now, what becomes interesting is that at times taxpayers may choose to adopt features for their intercompany loan which would result in a low risk outcome under the PCG in order to mitigate Australian transfer pricing risk. And what this may do is at times may have unintended consequences when it comes to pricing, which may not always be in accordance with the arm's length principle. And what I mean by that is potentially you might have pricing which is lower than the arm's length amount in order to result in a low risk outcome under the PCG. And while this is fine from an Australian perspective, it may mean that you've got transfer pricing risk in the lender's jurisdiction. I look at all my participants on the call today, loans from Singapore, from Hong Kong, from China, where the rate might be considered too low from the lender's jurisdiction. So the key takeaway from an Australian perspective is acknowledging that the PCG is a live document which is used by the tax office, is that there's a need to balance the need for pricing to be appropriate under arm's length principle, and just being cognizant that this may not necessarily result in the lowest risk outcome under the PCG. What this does mean, though, is that to the extent that your loan is not low risk under the PCG, even though it is, as the taxpayer believes, in accordance with arm's length principles, there's an additional need and real emphasis in such situations for preparing contemporaneous transfer pricing documentation to support and substantiate the position taken in the tax return. The only other point I'd mention, Dan, in passing, is that the OECD paper does make reference to the ability of local jurisdictions and tax authorities to apply local legislation to determine points around delineation, determining debt quantum, etc. And in the Australian, under the Australian rules, we have a bunch of various provisions, such as fee capitalisation and Division 974 debt equity rules, all of which are applied to determine amounts of debt versus equity capital and the capital structure of the Australian business. So it's right in line with what the OECD mentions up front as part of the paper.
That's great. Thank you, Ed. So it sounds like not a complete rewrite, but certainly some things to be aware of as we go forward. I guess, Jessica, coming to you next, is it a similar message from your point of view?
Thanks, Dan. So again, as there is no specific guidance in the Chinese regulations on FTTP, no major contradictions in the local legislations observed. However, overall, China's restriction on financial markets is gradually relaxing, but China still maintains forex controls, and moving cash in and out of China is still not easy if you compare to Hong Kong, Singapore, and Australia. Foreign debt caps still exist, so debt capacity analysis methods outlined in the paper may be less relevant for Chinese entities as they are required to operate within the relevant debt caps and quotas. Thin capitalization rules exist in China, which is 2-to-1 related party debt to equity ratio for non-financial institutions and 5-to-1 for financial institutions. And it limits interest deductions on debt exceeding these ratios. And China's interest deduction rules also limit deductions where related party interest rates are higher than those under comparable terms and conditions. But as the definition of comparable terms and conditions is very vague and there is currently no clear guidance, there is a potential that an artificial cap of sorts is placed on interest rates on cross-border loans, which requires taxpayers to provide robust documentary evidence and analysis to support their pricing.
That's great. Thank you, Jessica. Peter, same question to you.
Hong Kong follows very closely the OECD. In fact, actually, our new transfer pricing legislation even references the 2017 version of the transfer pricing guidelines. So the absence of any detailed guidance on applying financial transactions to the 2017 guidelines, I think it's quite likely that this new paper will start to be used by the Inland Revenue Department. And at some point, I'm expecting the law to be updated to incorporate this as well into our actual legal framework. I think when it comes to key contradictions, though, it's less around how Hong Kong would apply the arm's length principle and more to do with how the arm's length principle and transfer pricing coexists with Hong Kong's territorial-based taxation system, where, as it relates to interest income, Hong Kong will only tax interest income, which is of a Hong Kong source. And likewise, as I mentioned before, it's very difficult to get a tax deduction for interest expense that's lent from an overseas-related party other than in certain situations. So what we've got, and the way that the Hong Kong system tries to deal with this, is it first says you apply transfer pricing principles to determine an arm's length interest rate. You then apply local taxing principles to determine whether or not that interest income is taxable or whether the interest expense is deductible. And as a result, you can get some quite interesting situations where actually you're kind of being told to do a transfer pricing analysis on something which has very little Hong Kong tax impact. But making a slightly different assumption on source suddenly means it does have a Hong Kong tax impact. So I think there is a need to really understand how that sort of interacts with itself and works together. I guess the other sort of slight contradiction as well, which stems from the same issue, is when it comes to transfer pricing documentation. So again, the transfer pricing documentation rules will basically say that you have to document all intercompany transactions which are non-domestic. And that therefore means you may find yourself having to document transactions which ultimately have no Hong Kong tax impact because the interest income wouldn't be taxed in Hong Kong. And so groups need to think about how they're going to manage that and how do they, in effect, document their documentation strategy to kind of support that tax position as well as just the arm's length pricing.
That's great. Thank you, Peter. I guess, Lynn, coming to you last, you mentioned a few of the areas where the legislation and the OECD guidelines interact. Just touching on some of the key areas from a Singapore perspective.
Thanks, Dan. So in terms of key contradictions, I wouldn't say it's entirely contradictions, but like as mentioned earlier, the IRAS and their guidelines did say that they prefer a credit rating on a standalone basis. But it does go on to say that if it can be substantiated that an independent lender will accept group credit rating, the IRAS is prepared to accept the overall group credit rating. But again, because it stops there, it doesn't give kind of examples or more specific guidelines in terms of what situations and what types of level of substantiation. So it's kind of just to see if in subsequent revisions of the guidelines, whether the IRAS will be clearer in terms of when they do expect implicit support to be taken into account or what type of evidence they would like to see before they accept a group rating to be used as the appropriate credit rating.
Yeah, I think, Lynn, actually, sorry, if I can just make an observation, I think that really hits the nail on the head of some of the controversies of this paper, because clearly capital exporting countries like Singapore are very keen on standalone credit ratings because it has the potential to say, look, your subsidiaries are probably have quite low credit ratings, therefore the interest rates that you pay to Singapore should be quite high. Whereas most of the OECD are kind of net capital importers. And so there's been a lot of this pushback on limiting deductions and saying, taking into account implicit support to argue that local subsidiaries should share these kind of higher credit ratings and therefore should be paying lower interest rates. So I think that does kind of hit the nail on the head about these different perspectives from different tax authorities.
That's great. Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Peter, as well. I guess then coming on to practical aspects of this, so if I'm a taxpayer looking ahead to the next 6-12 months, what kind of areas should I be focusing on, given there's quite a lot, I guess, which we've heard about there and various things I could be focusing my time on? Ed, maybe if I come to you first.
Sure, Dan. And I think we all know, and I think we could unanimously agree, no matter which country we're based in, that in the new transfer pricing world, or tax world even, we have greater and greater transparency out there in the environment. And that's not just with country-by-country reporting. We have greater documentation requirements, as it's been touched on the call today, and we have a lot more information sharing, real-time information sharing between tax authorities. Now, what this cascades down to is that if I'm sitting there in a multinational group looking after the transfer pricing function, it really accentuates the need to prepare a logical, structured, global approach for pricing financing transactions across the group. And let's call that the global financial transactions transfer pricing policy. And when thinking about development of this policy, there are really three key questions which I think about when it comes to putting this together in a robust and effective way. The first question is, when I look at the multinational group, what is our global intercompany funding profile today and what's going to look like going forward? Is it going to be longer term loans? We're going to have some short term working capital facilities in there. We're going to have guarantees. Is it going to be a cash pool? What are the needs of the business? So you start off with understanding what the landscape's going to be in terms of your related party dealings. The second question then becomes, how do we build a global transfer pricing model which has, I'd call it structural consistency across the board, but yet at the same time has enough flex to cater for different fact patterns and situations, and at times local rules or tax authority preferences, which as we've heard today may sometimes differ to OECD or arm's length standards. And then finally, in light of the development of this policy, how do I prepare a contemporaneous evidentiary defence file which considers the accurate delineation of the transaction, has robust comparability analyses, and once again is based on the OECD and local principles to demonstrate reasonableness of approach? And while transfer pricing documentation is the starting point, when I talk about a defence file, I think about the documentation, but all the other supporting documents which underpin the pricing for the transaction and the position taken in the tax return, including board and C-suite documents around financing decisions, feasibility analyses around options available for what was transacted, treasury documents, correspondence with third-party lenders, financial models. So it's quite a wide, I guess, optionality of things that you can pull together to really support the underlying position in transfer pricing documentation. And I would say, upon reflection, I would say this is definitely the case in Australia, and I would even say a increasing trend around the world, not just in Asia, but in other markets. The evidentiary or documentation hurdle or standard expected by tax authorities has increased substantially over the last 5+ years. And we've seen that play out quite real time in risk reviews and audits. So the short answer to your question, Dan, is we know there's going to be increased scrutiny around financing transactions. It's just how do you get ahead of the curve, plan appropriately, develop your policy and evidence your position.
Thank you, Ed. Very interesting. I suppose before I move on, just one quick question in relation to Australian taxpayers specifically. I guess given the rules you had, the PCG you mentioned earlier, does that mean that taxpayers who have already started to comply with some of those guidelines will already have started to think about centralised policy and some of the other things you mentioned there?
Yeah, it's a very good question. The experience in Australia is what you allude to there because of the level of scrutiny and review of all transfer pricing arrangements, but focusing on financing the Australian market, I would say there has been an effect at a global level where because of reviews, because of the PCG, it really has, for Australian headquartered multinational groups, I think there's been a lot of development in the FT policy space over the last couple of years. And I would also say for inbound for foreign-owned multinational groups operating in Australia, the release of the PCG, if the group's been involved in a review or an audit in the Australian market, it definitely has made its way to regional head office, which has definitely kick-started conversations around intercompany financing policies and documentation as part of that process as well.
Thank you, Ed. Jessica, if I come to you next, what are the sort of practical aspects this Chinese taxpayers should be thinking about in the next 6-12 months?
Thanks, Dan. So as I mentioned earlier, the financial and regulatory environment in China is fast-moving and constantly changing. So a holistic approach, taking into account foreign remittance, tax, and transfer pricing is required. And coordination and communication between tax and treasury are crucial and should be started up as early as possible when looking at capital and debt deployment. On the other hand, we expect to see increasing scrutiny on financial transactions from the Chinese tax authorities, especially as the overall economy develops and more deployment or reallocation of capital across Chinese borders is needed. The tax authorities attach more importance to financial transactions and upskilling in this area. Groups will need to start thinking about their capital and debt structures, whether they have sufficiently robust and consistent financing policies in place, and how these policies and structures stand up under the increasing scrutiny in China and internationally. In short, documentation, documentation, and documentation.
Thank you, Jessica. So some consistent themes coming through here. Peter, is a similar documentation theme from a Hong Kong perspective?
It definitely is. I think that the Hong Kong flavor to the documentation point, though, is that actually 2019 is the first year that most groups are going to have to be doing mandatory local files and master files for Hong Kong. So as people are pulling those kind of documentation studies together, for many, it's the first year they're going to have to do it. And so therefore, I think it's just really important that you think through the strategy of how you're doing that. And also think through how you're thinking about it in light of the some of the conclusions of this paper, because I think what we want to make sure is that people are not having to reassess positions that they've documented the prior year. Much better to get your position set out for 2019 in a way that is hopefully consistent with the go forward position, so you don't have to change your position.
Great, thank you, Peter. And I guess just linking back to some of the earlier comments that Ed raised, is the importance there not just on the documentation, but also ensuring that consistent policy approach as well. So ensuring that, you know, not just the documentation is reflective of the Hong Kong policy, but actually that the policy itself is reflective of what the group does more generally, and that there is consistency between territories, given the ongoing profile of information sharing between territories becoming much more abundant.
I think that's definitely true. And I would say that I think Hong Kong groups, Hong Kong headquarter groups, having a financial transactions transfer pricing policy is still something that is a relatively new concept. So certainly something that, but definitely something that a lot are thinking about currently, and definitely worthwhile thinking about in light of the need to start to formally document things which may not have had to be formally documented before, because they need to go into things like a local file or a master file.
Fantastic, thank you, Peter. Lynn, coming to you last then, in terms of Singapore, any interesting additional themes or differences based on what we heard from the other speakers?
Sure, Dan. Singapore has had contemporaneous TPD requirements since 2014. It includes as one of the categories in which they have noted is for provision of guarantees. So with this OECD paper coming up and having clear guidance as to the appropriate transfer pricing around financial guarantees, we do expect that the IRAS at some stage will be providing guidance on financial guarantees as well. So I guess what in terms of anticipating, I would say that for Singapore taxpayers that are providing guarantees to its group companies, maybe it's a good time to start looking at the transfer pricing around the provision of guarantees. So that's one area. The other thing is also because Singapore is also a jurisdiction that provides and grants many tax incentives. A lot of these tax incentives, when granted, one of the conditions are that the transfer pricing has to be done appropriately. One of it is tax incentive for captive insurers. So in the past, captive insurers in Singapore if they qualify for the incentive, are tax exempt. But for new and renewed applications from 2018 onwards, these captive insurers will be subject to tax, but at a concessionary tax rate. Having said that, the condition of having transfer pricing appropriately set and priced is one of that condition. So again, given the guidance around captive insurers and the TP around that, I think that's an area again that taxpayers in that industry may wish to focus on sooner than later.
That's great. Thank you, Lynn. I guess some of the key themes there you've mentioned, so financial guarantees is something you touched on, which we've not focused on too much in this podcast, but something we've heard consistently is that the potential uptick in financial guarantees more generally, given this idea, as Ed mentioned earlier, that you know you do need to look at what the group is doing more generally, and if the group is using guarantees, then potentially that's something which should be pushed down to subsidiaries too. So it'll be interesting to see how that evolves from a Singapore perspective, but also across other regions and territories around the globe as well. I'd just like to thank all of my speakers for joining me and also for all of you for tuning in to listen today. Please look out for the other regional podcasts in this series, which will be covering EMEA and the Americas regions.
This podcast is brought to you by PwC, all rights reserved. PwC refers to the U.S. member firm or one of its subsidiaries or affiliates and may sometimes refer to the PwC network. Each member firm is a separate legal entity. Please see www.pwc.com/structure for further details. This podcast is for general information purposes only and should not be used as a substitute for consultation with professional advisors.